Like anything, where there's adversity, I see there's opportunity. And what I've seen a lot of business owners do, including ourselves, has been to go back and audit our business and say, right, well, this was a bit of a scare. This was a bit of a shake-up. How are we running business today? And what are the things that we could be doing better? And whether through processes, operations, retention, sales, all the rest of it. So it's certainly a good opportunity for business owners to be reviewing what they're doing today to ensure that if changes do come in 3 years' time, which is still hanging over our head, then we're well equipped for whatever that may be.
You are listening to Elevate, the official podcast of Elite Agent for real estate industry sales professionals, property managers and leaders. Each episode, we bring you the best minds in business and real estate to help you list more, sell more and elevate your results. To connect with all things Elite Agent, including the latest news, coaching and features, subscribe at our website, eliteagent.com.
Welcome to another episode of the Elevate podcast. I'm Samantha McLean, editor of Elite Agent.
And I'm Mark Edwards, the publisher of Elite Agent.
Woohoo! We're back again.
Well, here we are.
Absolutely. And this week we've got a bit of a different guest.
We do. I think one of the exciting things about having the opportunity to be able to pick and choose people to appear on the podcast is it doesn't necessarily need to be all the same people at the same time.
Well, no. I think part of learning to be a good leader, I think, and this is an episode of the Leadership Diaries, just so that we get that on the table now. Part of learning to be a good leader is learning from businesses outside of the real estate industry as well as businesses inside it. But in real estate, you've got a big ecosystem, right? You've got insurance brokers and mortgage brokers and things like that that really people's referral partners. And so this week, we've got our first finance broker.
Very exciting. And who is it, Sam?
Well, her name's Nancy Youssef, and she's written a book called Fear, Money, Purpose. And she is an award-winning finance broker. She's a mentor. She's the founder of Classic Finance and Classic Mentoring. So I'll tell you what's really interesting about Nancy is she mentors her competition.
Really?
Yeah, because she's a firm believer, like really interesting. I really love this interview actually is, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. And so, you know, the finance industry has not been without its struggles this year with the Royal Commission. And
they've taken a bit of a hiding, haven't they?
They have. So in this podcast, I did talk to Nancy a bit about the future of mortgage broking because there's still some findings to go from the Royal Commission, which are going to impact. But she did say that there's a lot of changes that have happened which have really impacted her margins. And it goes to show you that disruption's not just a technology thing. This is a legislative thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been wide-reaching, the effects that it's had, the inquiry. Everything from, you know, tightening up lending to having the on-flow effect of buyers not being able to get the finances they've been looking for. Thankfully, it's freeing up and we're seeing that activity come back into the market. But I think, you know, so Nancy has probably seen a lot of these things from a different side of the fence.
Yeah. And it's a very common story too, the way that she's built her business. So as a real estate agent, if you're building a team or say you're a solo agent, you've been out there for a while, the first thing you're going to be thinking about probably for 2020 is when do I take on a team member? You know, a lot of people say that's a challenge for them. When do they take on somebody new? And listening to Nancy's story, it was pretty much the same for her. So she was a solo broker and then kind of thought, well, how do I make sure that my income is steady? So she got a job as an educator and then realized that doing all things for all people was not terribly good for her health. So then she bit the bullet and took on an assistant while still doing the educating and still being a finance broker with the knowledge firmly in the head that as soon as you take on another body, then you're responsible for them. And so, yeah, it's a really interesting journey, actually, because, I mean, let's face it, you and I, every time we take on an employee, we feel a bit of fear too.
And
that's where the fear in the book title comes from. It's like, oh, okay, all right, I'm responsible for this now. Now what's going to happen?
Yeah, so there were a ton of nuggets in this one. I think we've captured the majority of them in the action guides.
In the action guide, yep. So I took some notes on this one. So if you'd like to get the show notes for this episode with Nancy, go to eliteagentelevate.com. and stick in your email address. And as if by magic, we will wing those notes over to you. We always have the last couple of notes from the last couple of episodes. They're free to download. And then if you want all the notes from all the episodes, you'll need to subscribe to Extra, which is a great way to support the show if you love the guests on the show. And to that, just go to eliteagent.com/extra.
And then once a month on your desk will come care of Australia Post, a nice big 40-page brochure or 40-page newsletter with all of the month's podcasts and probably sometimes even just a couple of extra bonus ones in there
as well. Well, we do. We always sneak a couple of extra tips in there of what we're seeing throughout the industry. So if you really want to stay right on the cutting edge of what we're seeing in the newsroom and in the podcast and everywhere, in fact, Extra is the place to be.
Absolutely. Hey, Sam, I'm really excited about this one. So let's get into it and on with the show.
All right. So welcome to the podcast, Nancy Youssef.
Thank you, Samantha, for having me.
It's a pleasure. Actually, you are the first finance broker that we've had on the Elevate podcast. So super excited to learn a bit more about finance broking as well as the book that you've written, which is called Fear, Money and Purpose.
Wow, that's a thrill. Thank you.
So it's been pretty interesting finance-wise in Australia for the last 12 months with the Banking Royal Commission and all of that sort of thing. So give us a bit of a helicopter view of what's been going on there from your angle.
Yeah, well, I mean, without getting into too much of the nitty-gritty, I think everybody saw that unfolding, you know, over the media and the news and the like. I guess looking at it from a small business perspective, and then personally, for me, the timing couldn't have been worse because it was on the eve of the release of the recommendations of the Royal Commission that I was about to hit play on publishing.
Yeah.
And you can imagine here I am, I've written a book about, you know, fear and small business owners. And the biggest significant event that had happened that I'd written about in the book had been the GFC. So all of a sudden I felt, has my book just become irrelevant overnight because there's no references being made to the Royal Commission? So we kind of pulled it back, went back, did some work on it just to reference the Royal Commission. But certainly that week was a very turbulent week once the findings and the recommendations had been released, particularly with a lot of colleagues who were, you know, like myself, uncertain of, well, what's going to happen? I mean, if they're looking at taking away our trailing income, which for you know, a real estate office is like taking away your rent roll.
Yeah.
You know, that's how many years of investment into getting that to the level that it was, or even what's my business going to be worth? Is this industry going to be viable? You know, what's going to happen to compliance? Are we going to need to hire more people? So there was all those questions being thrown up. And then on the other side, you've got the new entrants, because I do a lot of mentoring in our industry. Many of the new entrants I work with are less than 2 years experienced. Some had only started in the preceding quarter,
yeah,
and have gone, what sort of an industry have I just come into? Is it even going to be around in the next 2 years? So certainly a lot of dialogue had been happening, a lot of conversation. But like with anything, I think the elections sort of happened. It then was, let's leave everything as it is for now. I mean, there were a few changes being made from, you know, the banking side of things, certainly for compliance. There's things coming in like, you know, best interest duty and those sorts of things, which I'm not going to go into too much. But what I think, like anything, where there's adversity, I see there's opportunity. And what I've seen a lot of business owners do, including ourselves, has been to go back and audit our business and say, right, well, this was a bit of a scare. This was a bit of a shakeup. How are we running business today, and what are the things that we could be doing better, whether through processes, operations, retention, sales, all the rest of it. So it's certainly a good opportunity for business owners to be reviewing what they're doing today to ensure that if changes do come in 3 years' time, which is still hanging over our head, then we're well equipped for whatever that may be.
Yeah, at least it's given you a bit of time to think about it. And I think, you know, that's probably, it's good advice for any business.
I think with any business, one thing it does make you realize is, hey, I've been so caught up in the day-to-day and being reactive, I haven't actually been proactive. And it's typical. It's something that, you know, everyone's out to try and, you know, bring money in and pay the bills and have cash flow looked after. And sometimes it's those things that really shake you up and you think, hey, I've got to really go back to what we're doing and why we're doing it and making sure that we are going to be viable and relevant with all these different, you know, competitors coming in.
Yeah, absolutely. So give us a bit of background on you. How did you actually get into finance broking?
By mistake.
That's what people say about real estate.
No, not really. I mean, I guess it was quite an interesting journey in that I'd been working in international freight and logistics for, you know, most of my 20s, and I'd been studying marketing management. And on that journey, I'd invested in my first property because I had this thing. I know it's, you know, a cliche, but a man's not a financial plan, and I've got to really look after myself as a woman. And if I want to be independent, I really need to set myself a little bit of a, you know, an investment path. And so naive and no idea really, bought my first property and obtained that loan through a bank. Not knowing and reading the fine print, it wasn't the best loan that I got. And then, you know, about a year later, I'd met a financial planner and thought it's time I started to actually take proper advice and invest in good advice. I guess advice I give my clients today. But yeah. So on that journey, I was actually the client from hell. I gave this guy a really hard time. And by the end of it, he'd introduced me to a bank manager who was looking to refinance my loan. And, you know, being that I had this serious mistrust of banks, I really bagged this poor guy. And by the end of it, he'd offered me a job. And so I got into the banking and finance industry. There's a whole backstory with that. But got into the industry and just felt that I had a real knack for numbers, but most importantly, for helping people. And fast forward a few years, doing a few different roles across banking. I also got involved in training and development with finance company. Did a few different stints. And in late 2003, I was born with this, you know, entrepreneurial flair and spirit coming from a family that was all self-employed. So it just felt to be right that I'd set up my own business to help people and to explain finance and make finance accessible in plain English and help people like myself who had gone off and ventured into their first property to, you know, get into theirs. And so Classic Finance was born, and yeah, 16 years later, we're still here.
And the rest, they say, is history. And you've written this amazing book called Fear, Money, Purpose, mm-hmm. and we're going to talk a fair bit about that today, actually. But what inspired you to write that book in the first place?
Yeah, so my 14-year-old self was an avid reader. Yep. And at that point, I had all these, you know, as you do when you're a teenager, trying to work out what's my career going to be. And that sort of went from, you know, law to journalism to, you know, and I really loved the arts. I loved literature. I loved English. And at school, that was sort of what I really focused on. And then with a few things that sort of panned out with my life at that point, I always wanted to write a book. I loved the smell of books. I loved being in libraries. Even with technology, I've never really been one for Kindles and things. So it was just a bucket list item and something, a goal that I've always had. And, you know, every January you'd sit down and look at the year ahead and plan some goals for the year. And the book was always there, but it was always like a long-term goal. And in late 2017, I had a bit of a wake-up call, you know, but seriously broke my foot, and it was horrible because for 6 weeks I was literally off my feet, as they say. And it was a time of real reflection about a lot of things that were going on career-wise and personally. And so looking at the journey that I'd had for 16 years going, you know, here I am, I've built one company, I've built a second, which is Classic Mentoring and Coaching and helping, you know, a lot of startups and entrepreneurs on their business journey. Really started to reflect on my why and why I'd been in business for so long and what I wanted to achieve. I don't have any children, so I thought, you know, it's really legacy for me. You know, this whole business journey is about legacy. Like, what do I want to be remembered for? What impact do I want to have on our industry? And so I started to pull back and think, you know, pulled out some of my goals and thought, well, what is there here that I could achieve? Some big goal that I haven't really addressed. And the book was one. And from that, I started to sketch out just some chapters and some, you know, brainstorming some things that I'd want to talk about. And it didn't just happen overnight. It was a bit of a process. But once I made my mind up that I was going to do it, I had to get over the fear of being vulnerable in a book and everything else. So Fear, Money, Purpose was born. And it was an 18-month labor of love from that thought of I'm going to do it to it landing on a shelf. And yeah, it's certainly been an interesting journey.
Yeah, absolutely. So Fear, Money, Purpose. So talk to me about fear, because that's a big word to begin the title with. So what, explain the fear part of it to me.
Yep. So that started really when I started to think about all of the things I could write about. Now, as a finance broker, one thing I knew was that I didn't want it to be a book about finance. Now, I still own Classic Finance. It's a business I've had, but I've been off the tools for about 4 years. So I don't do a lot I've got a capable team. But the fear part was really, it came from my own personal self first, and it really started with the fear of writing a book. Yeah. But when I started to look back on my career and a lot of the limiting beliefs and things that I'd put on my own self and things that had stopped me from achieving some of those goals, it wasn't too dissimilar to clients that I've also dealt with, and it didn't matter whether those clients were turning over $200,000 a year, or they were a sole trader, or whether they were turning over millions of dollars a year. In business, fears are very, very similar. And it's just the magnitude of them that, you know, it comes down to, it's all relative, really. And so, but then there was also a different set of fears. It was also seeing people that were playing it safe for so long and not leaving that job or that corporate role, even though they wanted to have more flexibility and freedom, or they always had this dream to start their own business. So looking at all of the different fears, it really, I guess the title of fear being the first one stemmed from my own personal fears. Mm. And then that was what catapulted into the case studies that are in the book as well.
Yeah, actually, I think there's some great case studies drawn from your own example. And definitely there was one early in the book that I could really relate to, and I know a lot of real estate agents will relate to, is about taking on your first employee.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, there is an incredible fear around reputation. There is an incredible fear around, will I be able to pay for them? Will they perform? Will they be able to do the job? Like, all of those things being there.
Just do what I did, and I offered her a one day a fortnight. That's how safe I was playing it.
Yeah, but I had a look at your website and she's still with you.
Yes, she is. Yeah. And I think we laugh about that, you know, all the time, because what I didn't realize at that point was, you know, when you're looking at things with such tunnel vision, and you can be very clouded because fear does cloud your judgment. It does cloud your creativity. And they're relevant fears. I mean, you know, when you're thinking about being responsible for hiring somebody and paying for them, and if you've got a downturn or business isn't, you know, performing, then it's a very valid fear, especially that you don't want to stuff anyone around, really. You want to be a good employer. But what I didn't realize when I did hire her one day a fortnight was that, I mean, that didn't last very long. I think within a month or something, I was asking her to come on almost, you know, a few days a week. But the art of delegation.
Yeah.
And I think with business owners, we're control freaks and, you know, no one can do anything better than you. And that was my whole theory, is that, no, you know, reputational fear, can she look after my clients the way I have? And there was a whole level of fears that were part of that process. But when I realized how good she was at so many things that I wasn't actually that great at, and put my ego aside, that was where I was, you know, discovered the art of delegation. And I think, yeah, that's something really important in business.
Absolutely. So do you have any good tips on delegating?
Delegate fast.
Yeah.
Don't hang on to it. I think, look, before you can even delegate, I think you've really got to look at yourself. And I'm very good at doing that now. Going back, you know, 9 years ago, it was probably a little bit different. But my advice now to a lot of business owners and the ones that I work with are, recognize what your strengths are. Firstly, what are you really good at? And secondly, what are your skills that add value to the business to help it grow? If you're caught up in what I call the $25 an hour stuff, you're not actually giving your business the oxygen it needs to grow.
Yeah.
So anything you can outsource or delegate that is not worth your time, i.e. bookkeeping or admin or compliance or any of those things, you know, get rid of those things first. But really work on, one thing I say to a business owner is, you want to wake up in the morning and go to your business and feel like you're not going to work because you're enjoying everything that you do. Now, in saying that, it is easier said than done, and it has been a process for me to get to. But I think once you recognize what you're very good at, then you can plug in the areas of your business that you're not so good at, whether that's social media or marketing or whatever it might be, and have people that are actually better at you doing those things, because that will help your business grow. And when you're working together as a team, that's where the magic really happens.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, it's funny you mentioned bookkeeping, because that happened very early on for you. And I remember that was the first thing I gave away to, was the bookkeeping, because I just, you know, there are so many good bookkeepers in the cloud now that there's no excuse. But I was really interested too in the level up. So just fast forward a few chapters, and you talked about taking on a CFO, which was a really big decision.
Mm.
And I can understand that because they're not cheap. Mm. But it was really worth it, right?
Absolutely. And I didn't even know that you could actually, as a small business owner, I mean, CFOs are for corporates, you know.
Yeah.
Who the hell is my company to take on a CFO? But at that point, again, I'd let go of the books because for so long I'd held on to the books. I'm the numbers girl, so I can do my own MYOB. I don't need somebody to do it.
Yeah.
But what I realized was it was taking up, you know, 6 to 8 hours a month of my time that I could be out generating business, which is where my strength is. The CFO piece was similar in that, yes, I understand financials. Yes, I can read them. I am a numbers girl. But when I had two companies running parallel side by side and there was two bank accounts and two lots of expenses and lots of budgeting and forecasting that we had to do, I started to feel the overwhelm. And it wasn't the overwhelm that I couldn't do it. It was just that I didn't have time. I was so busy having to go out and generate leads and manage our existing clients, manage the team and do the marketing and lead gen, all the rest of it. So for me, it was more of a safety net to have somebody there that could actually look at the numbers each month and find the trigger points that would say, okay, if we keep doing this for the next 3 months, we'll be able to put on another person. You can pay that person X, or whether it was, if we do this for the next 6 months, we'll be able to move into this premise. So I wanted to be able to make good decisions and not just go with my gut for everything, because a lot of business owners operate, you know, from that gut perspective.
Yeah.
And for me, it was more about, as the business was growing really, really fast, I was starting to, you know, get a little bit anxious about it and think, well, no, I really need to make good decisions. And, you know, let's face it, you're not seeing your accountant every week. It's not someone that, you know, you go and see every single week. So I wanted somebody that was involved in the business that could look at the numbers and set some very serious, you know, targets and cash flow and budgeting.
Yeah, interesting.
And it was worth every cent. I mean, he was a contract CFO, so he does this as a service for other small business owners.
And you can just find, is there a particular person that you dealt with, or can you can just?
There's different ones. I mean, you can obviously go online and there's, you know, contract CFOs. But I think the first step is really speak to your accountant, because they normally, if they don't offer that service internally, they would normally be working with somebody. So I was able to get that through our accountant.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so in the book also you've got some good tips for making smart money decisions. So what, say, would be your top three, other than maybe looking at getting a CFO in?
Yeah. So, I mean, look, there's a whole lot of them. I think having a budget is really, really important, but also removing a lot of the excess spend. Sometimes it's just that we've done something this way for so long that we haven't reviewed it. And it's really important to really look at what the business is spending money on each month. The other thing is really negotiating with your suppliers. How often do you review the prices that you're receiving for some of the services that you're paying? If you've been pretty loyal to a particular company for some time and, you know, you've been working with them and the price has not been reviewed for a while, there's nothing wrong with being able to speak to them and say, hey, you know the gist, you know how our business operates. It's kind of on autopilot now. Is there anything we can do here? Or have you got newer? It's no different to really renegotiating your phone plans or your utility bills or any of those things. The same needs to be done in business. I think consolidating, you know, your bad debt, if you've got any bad debt in the business, and looking at ways to pay that off, you know, again, with having payment arrangements for different things, sometimes that can help cash flow. So, yeah, there's a whole stack of them in there, especially when you're starting out. One piece of advice we give to a lot of our business startups is, can you look at some co-working space or subletting an office? First, you still have that professional image from day one, so you're not working out of your garage.
Yeah.
But number two, it's a great way to also meet people when you're working in a lot of these co-working spaces.
Yeah, I think that's great advice for real estate businesses, I think, because if you become part of a WeWork community or a WhatsO community, or there's a whole bunch of them here, then, you know, you're automatically getting to know, well, prospects, aren't you?
You are. And a lot of these places also offer you the ability to do presentations, lunchtime presentations on your business and your offering.
Yep.
You know, so that's a great way to also get your name out there. And it's like anything. I think people just think, oh, well, I've got my logo, I've got my business cards, my website's up. Great. business is going to come in the door. No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
You have to prospect daily. And the only way to do that is to be around people.
Yeah.
And the more people you meet, the more chances you're going to be able to convert some business.
Make some good human connections.
Correct, yeah.
Lastly, just before we get into the leadership diaries, which is something I'm keen to do with you, seeing as you've got a couple of small businesses and you've had the whole entrepreneurship journey, but one thing that I found really interesting in the book is that you actually mentor your competition.
Yeah.
So
there's a big pie for everybody.
Yeah.
If I could take it on myself, I would have taken it on. But, you know, and a lot of people have been really skeptical about that over the years. And I think even when I first started, there was a little bit of resistance as to, we don't get your model. Like, you're actually mentoring your competitors. Mm. And for me, it's about having an abundant mindset. In business, you can either be, you can have a scarcity mindset and keep everything really, really close to your chest, or you can collaborate and have an abundant mentality. And I think the latter has actually worked for me. What I've found is that the more we've given, the more our business has grown. The more that we share, the better the industry. For me, I've mentioned earlier, it's about legacy and what I want to be remembered for. I'm certainly not going to be around and, you know, owning a finance business forever. And certainly it's an industry that, you know, we've been talking about raising professional standards for a very long time. And so that was something that I took on board because of my passion for education.
Yeah.
Purely and simply, I love to educate people, whether it's a client that's looking to get into the property market or whether it's somebody that just doesn't understand what the borrowing options are for them. For our business owners, it's no different. It's hey, these are all the mistakes I made. Don't make them. And if I can teach you everything I've learned in 16 years in two, then you're going to have much better chance of success. And so watching a lot of my competitors win awards because I've helped mentor them is also something that I get a lot of satisfaction out of.
Yeah.
Because I believe that there's such a big market. I mean, 60% of loans are now, residential loans are now being written through broker channel, which is huge for Australia. And I think that the more professional operators we get into the industry who, and the other thing is that you look at the statistics of how many small business owners fail in the first couple of years, you know, in the first 5 years of business, it's huge. Mm. And in our industry, it was sitting at about 60%, 65% were failing. And so to address that attrition rate, because let's face it, people like me who've been around for a long time aren't going to be here forever. You want to have an industry that's sustainable into the future because it is actually a good industry for the Australian population.
Yeah, I know when the Royal Commission findings first came out and everything like that, there was a lot of our industry, the real estate industry, that were quite upset for you all. In fact, you know, like I think one of them, Stu Benson, started a viral campaign on Facebook to, you know, help a mortgage broker. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, look, I love that because, you know, it's kind of like a rising tide lifts all boats.
Yeah. And you know, I think we can. I mean, we rise by lifting others. It's one of my sayings. Like, I love it. You know, the more that we can help, you know, especially startups and a lot of people that need guidance. I certainly know when I came in, there was no mentoring. It was a very scarcity mindset. There wasn't a lot of collaboration that went on. And being in a male-dominated industry, I mean, look, I love, you know, I've had some very good males in my life who've had really good sound advice from. But, you know, it today's world, the way business is being done with technology and the meetups that we have and the networking groups that are out there, you seem every second week there's a new one starting. Business is done a lot more collaboratively, and I think that's where there's enough of a pie for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we're going to launch into the leadership diaries now.
You're eager for that.
Which is, it's very simple series of questions that we ask leaders such as yourself,
yeah,
to inspire other up-and-coming leaders, whether they be in real estate or finance broking or wherever.
Yep.
So are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, here we go.
I'm a bit nervous, but I'm ready.
No, don't be nervous. It's all good. Okay, so what does the first hour of your day look like? Are you a 5 a.m. clubber or do you have a different sort of morning routine? How does your day normally roll?
No, so I do tend to wake up naturally quite early. So 6 a.m. I'm usually awake. That doesn't mean I spring out of bed and I'm into action mode. No, I sort of try to ease into my mornings. I feel like that first, I call it the calm before the storm. I'm very time managed, so I usually have my appointments planned and I know exactly what I'm doing. But a couple of mornings a week I do Pilates, which I love. Mm. And I also fit in 2 to 3 power walks of a morning as well during the week. So that sets me up from a wellness perspective. outside of that, it's usually whatever appointments I've got planned, and I try and plan what I call my ideal week a few weeks in advance. So I usually try and book the diary 2 to 3 weeks in advance.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. Mm-hmm. Can you name someone that has had a tremendous impact on you as a leader?
Wow. Somebody. There's been so many awesome people in my life who've impacted me in one way or another. If we're looking at one person, going to Necker Island, I sort of got to meet Richard Branson, and that was quite an interesting story, which is chapter 4. Yep. But personally and directly, I think looking at, you know, role models such as Michelle Obama, I think she does amazing things. I've had different mentors. So I don't think that you can have one mentor that fits every need that you possibly have. So I've been very lucky and fortunate to meet different people who have mentored me in different ways along the way, and in different areas that I've needed help with.
You know, I think that too, actually, is that if you don't outgrow a coach in a particular area, then they're probably not doing a great job of coaching you.
Yeah, because, I mean, I look at even our CFO's had good impact on us from a numbers perspective and helping grow the business. But then I've had the Business Chicks community who've been amazing, because I've met some awesome people and made some very good friendships through that network. And some of them I probably won't name just for privacy reasons, yeah. But who are very good friends. And I've been able to soundboard a lot of things over the years with them. But I've invested significantly too in my own professional development. So, yeah.
Where do great ideas in your business come from, and how do you work out what's a priority?
I'm trying to hold back my laughter here, because if you were talking to my team, you'd probably hear them say, tell her to stop thinking of them. As an entrepreneur, I say, is it a curse or is it a talent? But I think it's actually a talent. I think as an entrepreneur, you've usually got about 3,000 ideas going a day, and the brain is always busy. You know, there's always that new shiny thing that you want to work on, because we're fast moving. We see, you know, the world in a very optimistic light, and that optimism creates a certain energy, and then that energy creates action, and that action then, you know, means we've got to come up with strategy. But coming up with ideas, I'm the ideas lady. So they call me the one that's got the ideas. And then execution's probably not my favourite part. I do it in that I am structured. But, yeah, a lot of that comes from just, you know, I don't know. I mean, ideas just pop into my head. It's just, you know, it's, I think the more that you experience, and the more failures that you have, or the more mistakes that you made, the more that you are willing to explore newer things and things that may have scared you in the past, that you think, hey, but what if I can actually do that? And when you do and you achieve it, it just sets you up for setting that next big idea or that next big goal. So I've written one book and people are like, oh, what's next? And so it's like, yeah, the second book.
Yeah, I think speaking to a few authors, once you've got one out, the second one is easier.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
What is your favourite question to ask someone in a job interview, and what does the answer tell you about them?
My favourite question, it's usually, what makes you stress?
Yeah.
And I like to know what makes people stress, because it's not just about, and I talk about it not just from a business perspective. I say, in your life, what are the two or three things that cause you the most stress? Because that tells you a whole lot more than just what they come back at you with.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you kind of know what sort of pressure, I suppose,
can take, because we are in a high pressure environment and we're on deadlines all the time.
Yeah.
So, and then just goes to show what kind of resilience they have, and, you know, whether they are cut out for that role, but also personally, what sort of tends to cause them stress is really important.
There was a great story in the book, actually, about a deal that you were doing with someone, and you'd got him approved X amount, and he was supposed to go and buy property with that money. Yeah. And then came back and said, well, I've put an offer in on something.
Double the value.
Yeah.
Just make it happen. Yeah, sure. No problem. We're Harry Potter.
Yeah.
That was huge stress. And I think had I not had the team that I had, and probably having the resilience that I had, we would not have been able to deliver on that deal, because it was an absolute nightmare. But we got it done under such extreme pressure. And part of me, I was overseas for 2 weeks out of that process, which made it even worse.
Yeah.
But we did get it done, and it was just about keeping calm and maintaining, really leveraging the relationships we had in the industry at that time. but really sort of communication is really important.
I guess that that is where too, you know, having those great human relationships must really help, because sometimes, yeah, you can't just wave a magic wand and...
But in an era of technology, everyone hides behind emails. And a lot of the time I have to actually say, like, to, you know, business owners, why don't you just pick up the phone? Like, actually give someone a call or get them to come in and flesh this problem out face to face. Because, you know, we can all hide behind emails, but it doesn't really get you the traction that you need. And also when you're starting out a business, we get all of our startups to really start making relationships with their business managers, with lenders and other stakeholders in the industry. So, yeah.
Okay, so what sort of advice would you give someone going into a leadership position for the first time, or someone that wanted to start their own business for the first time? What advice would you give them?
Well, the first piece of advice we give a lot of our business owners is make sure you've got a financial plan around that. Getting into business, we interview a lot of candidates that are wanting to start their own business. And one of the reasons I ask them, the two things I ask them, why do you want to do this? Now, if there's not a passionate answer around it, if it's just for money, then generally it's probably not the right business, because the money side of it will come. But there's a lot more investment from you that has to happen before that, that return really starts to show. And I think one of the main reasons that a lot of business owners feel pressure in that first couple of years is because they don't have enough money put aside to pay their bills, or, you know, especially if they're the sole breadwinner at home. A lot of them will fail within a few months, because it's like building a pipeline of business in finance takes a lot of time, and you're constantly prospecting. It's not like you open a store and there's a product on the shelf and people are going to come in and buy it. You actually have to get out there and, you know, develop a brand, have people know what you do. You're competing with a lot of established business owners. So you're the new kid on the block. And if you don't have enough money put away to help sustain you during that period, plus having the passion for getting into that business to begin with, then you're going to be short-lived. And when the times hit where there is tight cash flow, or deals fall over, or things don't convert, you need to be able to say, look, it's okay, it didn't happen, but this is what I've learned out of this, and this is what I'm going to do to move forward. But you can't do that if you're not passionate about it and if you don't have a strong vision for why you're doing what you do. So really understand your why, like, why am I getting into this? And a lot of startups that I've seen very successful, their why is very similar. And most of them have been, I want to help people. I actually want to help people obtaining finance. It's more than just my trail. You know, anyone that comes in and says, I just want to build a solid trail book, it's not enough to sustain you. I mean, we're all in business to make money. There's no doubt about it. Why would you get into business if you're not? But there's got to be more than I want to build a good trail book, or I just want flexibility. Flexibility will come, but it won't be in the first few years. You're doing everything in that business.
So this is where the purpose bit comes in, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So you discovered your purpose throughout your journey, which was doing some charity work. Mm. I think I read that you went to Malawi.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit about how you discovered your purpose and your why.
Yeah, and I think if you'd asked me in 2003 when I started, what's my purpose going to be, I would have looked at you blankly and thought, my real purpose is that I want to be able to travel whenever I want to travel and not have to fill in an annual leave form. That was as naive as I was at that point. But fast forward, you know, a couple of decades nearly in self-employment, purpose didn't just land on my, you know, in my cereal bowl one morning and I was like, that's it. I found my purpose. No, it's been an ongoing journey. It's been a journey of self-discovery, because much as you build a business and you're creative in it and you create something that you are so proud of, it also comes down to why you're doing what you're doing. And self-reflection is so important along the way. For me, when I start to feel in my business that I'm no longer challenged in doing something, that's when I realize, hey, I've got to set myself that next big goal. But again, when I come back to legacy, it was, again, what's, you know, how do we set a good example for people in our industry to give back and do more? And it was for me really about how can I affect a meaning in what we do as well, not just from the profit side of things. Yes, we're delivering a great service. Our clients are happy. We've got a lot of repeat business. We don't have to prospect as hard anymore because, you know, it just becomes an organic thing. But for me, it was really about, well, again, when I retire one day or when I'm 80, I want to look back and say, well, during my business journey, my business was able to help X amount of people buy homes. We helped, you know, X amount of 100 startups get into their own business. And we also gave this much back to those less fortunate, or whether we helped, you know, a particular charity. And so at that point, I started to research charities. And I wanted to find a charity that wasn't just about writing a check. I wanted to find a charity that we could all get involved in from a grassroots level. And that's when I discovered the Hunger Project through the Humankind Project. And the Hunger Project is, the work of the Hunger Project takes place impoverished communities around the world, particularly in Africa. And at that point, I didn't even know. I'd never been to Africa. I'd only grown up with World Vision, you know, and the 40-hour famine and things like that I did at school, sponsoring a child, those sorts of things. And so when I started to understand what the work of the Hunger Project does, and particularly around microfinance, what I realized was their work in impoverished communities was no different to the work that we were doing here in Western communities, because they were providing mentoring, education, leadership, training to these villages to help bring them out of, you know, out of poverty and help them become the solution to their own problem. And they were doing that through microfinance. So capital is key. And, you know, in these communities, microfinance is what really is the oxygen to help them to become a sustainable community. So I started my fundraising in 2015, not having been to the front line. In 2017, I went and visited Malawi, and that was life-changing in so many ways. And my commitment was just further reinforced after going there and spending time seeing what the effects of microfinance could do. And I knew that for $280, that could build a house for somebody over there with bricks and a tin roof. And that meant that a family of four or five people could actually have shelter. Where I'd gone, the houses were made of clay and straw roofs, and the moment that any, you know, heavy rain was there, that those houses would collapse. So they have nothing. They literally had no, you know, or whether $60 would fund a new business owner. So when I started to look at, you know, geez, $280, we spend that on I don't know what without even realizing, it just further reinforced what I wanted to do. So part of that role now with Purpose has been that, you know, for every home we fund here, we fund a home there. For every entrepreneur we help mentor here, we mentor there. And for us, if you had told me 4 years ago that the business would have raised close to $140,000 for microfinance and the Hunger Project, I would have said no way. But here we are, and we're about to run our fifth event in 3 weeks' time. So
amazing. Awesome job. Awesome job. Yeah. Normally this is the point where I say, is there anything that you're afraid to do that you would do if you weren't afraid to do it? But I know you've conquered a big fear on Necker Island. So tell us about zip lining.
Oh, well, it wasn't so much the zip line. I mean, yeah, zip lining was a fear. Like I'm not an adrenaline junkie, sports fanatic or anything like that. So I think doing something that was really out of my comfort zone wasn't so much just about zip lining. It was about the fact that I did zip line. Then what am I scared of with everything else that I'm not doing? It was the catalyst for getting over other fears. And I think it just, when I realized that I didn't fall off the rope and I didn't, you know, crash and burn or anything like that, it kind of was, a time of reflection on other things that I'd been holding back within business and within some of the goals that I've been wanting to achieve. You know, other fears I had of flying, you know, I mean, I've traveled over 20 countries and I still get apprehensive to get on a flight to Melbourne, you know, because I'm just not a plane. You know, I've never been one to fly comfortably. I used to get motion sickness and things like that. So my earlier experience of flying weren't always great. And I think that sort of set this fear around it. And I've managed it a lot better now. But, you know, when you're having to get on a plane that's a six-seater aeroplane across the Caribbean to get to Necker Island, you've sort of stressed out about it. But some of the other fears, you know, were about myself, comparing myself to other people. I mean, even to go on that journey, you know, you get serious imposter syndrome. And I know that it's a word that's used a lot, but it is definitely something that I see even some of the most successful people you know, really suffer from. And when you're comparing yourself to everyone else's achievements, sometimes you can also put these limiting beliefs on yourself. Mm. And I think for me, it was really about taking away all those shackles of things that I had thought, oh, I've got to be this way or that way, or I've got to be a particular person to be accepted, or I've got to be turning over a certain amount of money to make it into the big guys club. And going to Necco Island, I was there with businesses that were probably 10 times the size of mine, if not more. And there were some who were probably turning over less than I was. And it didn't matter because at the end of the day, we were all there. There was no ego. And it was just about how we can all be of service and how we can do what we're doing and become better leaders in everything that we're doing on a day-to-day basis. So for me, Necco Island started that journey. But also in what I'm doing with charity, that's showing leadership. What I do every day is showing up to my office and being there for my team who need guidance or need help or need support and, you know, really leading from inside out, you know. And I think too often we're all about, like a lot of people sort of out there, what's in this for me? But when you can actually start to lead from within, that's a whole different level of leadership.
Yeah, absolutely. Leading with your heart.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
So you gained financial freedom pretty early on in your journey, I think, based on your investments in the business and all that sort of thing. What would be the biggest tip that you could give someone about gaining financial freedom?
I don't think you're ever financially free. I'd love to say I don't have any debt. I do.
It's a phrase that gets thrown around a lot these days, this financial freedom thing.
And I think it's different for everybody. I think, again, like with anything I say, reverse engineer the life you want. Okay. So I didn't understand that early in the piece. All I knew was it was the right thing to go in and invest in property because I needed to set myself up so that I would have something for when I retired. That was as simple as it was. But what I realized was that investing early meant that I had growth in property and equity that enabled me to set up businesses, travel, do a lot of the professional, like, you know, go to Necco Island, do the things that I've wanted to do in my life. Now, we're all driven by different purpose. For some, you know, being able to send their three kids to a private school is purpose. And that's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Or give the kids something that we never got. That's their purpose. Or whether it's somebody who volunteers at the local nursing home, that's purpose. So purpose takes, you know, shape for us in all different ways. But I think when we talk about financial freedom, and I say this to clients, it's like, if you could have everything you wanted financially, you know, what would that look like? Now, within reason, I mean, you know, if they're being not so serious about it, then, you know, it's something that you've really got to get to the roots of. But I look at, what do I need? How much do I need to survive? What do I need to do? And is my life really about accumulating assets, or is it about making memories and having a lifestyle? So they're the sorts of things that some of the questions that we ask. And I think really, you know, I really believe a lot in having a vision, and I think vision boards are really good. Certainly I've got one. You know, manifesting things I think is really important, you know, being able to be clear about goals. But goal setting, we just throw that around like, yeah, I've got some goals. Yeah, but how often do you review them? How often do you actually look at them? And how often do you sit down and go, how close am I to achieving it? And if I'm not, why? And usually that's got some fear attached to it, you know, that achieving that goal has got some fears attached to it. So it's really about trying to unpack what those fears are. And I've got some tips in the book that talks about that. But for me, it was about picturing the life that I wanted and then being able to go, right, so what am I doing to get towards that? What do I need? What are the resources I need? And what's the advice that I need? And surrounding myself with people that can help me on that journey as well. So getting no advice is very expensive.
Yeah, it's funny. People balk at getting advice because it is expensive, but, you know.
But no advice is more expensive because, you know, the mistakes that can be made, the time that's wasted. And, you know, the do-it-yourself route is not always the best route. And I think I know that if I'm trying to put something together at home, I'd rather spend, you know, $100 and get it assembled than spend 2 days trying to work it out, you know. And it's no different to what you're doing in terms of your own financial future. If you don't get the right advice and set yourself up in the right way, whether it's in business or in personal, you'll make a lot of mistakes. And I did that. I mean, I think, I don't know how many websites we went through before we knew that, hey, we should probably invest in a proper developer to do this, you know?
Yeah, I call it the black hole of the web. We've been there and done that one too.
Do it yourself's not always cheap.
Yeah.
And advice, and no advice is certainly not a good strategy.
Yeah, that is excellent advice. So we're going to leave a ton of links in the show notes for the book and some of the other things that you've mentioned today. And thank you, Sam. You've been very generous with your knowledge as I was reading about on the weekend. But if there was one piece of advice that you could leave our listeners with, what would it be?
Just go for it. I don't say it as a cliche, and I'm not just saying it like a Nike ad, just do it. I actually really mean it. I think we're only here once and you want to give it the best shot you can. I mean, if you're feeling that you're not energized by what you do on a day-to-day basis, then change it. Don't ignore it. Don't put stuff under the carpet, because that's the easy way to go and just exist. Where, you know, life is too precious just to exist. Really have a go. And I think that there's a solution to everything. So just unpack it and get clear about what you're trying to achieve.
Brilliant. Nancy Youssef, thank you so much.
Thank you.
To connect with all things Elite Agent, including the latest news, coaching and features, subscribe at our website, eliteagent.com.